today. Think it over."
Frodo looked panic-stricken. "Oh, dear God, this will be the death blow for the company. Think of how many families will lose their livelihood if it gets out that Martin..." Frodo rocked back and forth, juggling with a moral dilemma.
"That's one issue. If Isabella Vanger is to inherit, you may think it would be inappropriate if she were the first one to light upon her son's hobby."
"I have to go and see..."
"I think you should stay away from that room today," Salander said sharply. "You have a lot of things to take care of. You have to go and tell Henrik. And you have to call a special meeting of the board and do all those things you chaps do when your CEO dies."
Frodo thought about what she was saying. His heart was thumping. He was the old attorney and problem-solver who was expected to have a plan ready to meet any eventuality, yet he felt powerless to act. It suddenly dawned on him that here he was, taking orders from a child. She had somehow seized control of the situation and given him the guidelines that he himself was unable to formulate.
"And Harriet?" "Mikael and I are not finished yet, but you can tell Herr Vanger that I think now that we're going to solve it."
Martin Vanger's unexpected demise was the top story on the 9 o'clock news on the radio when Blomqvist woke up. Nothing was reported about the night's events other than to say that the industrialist had inexplicably and at high speed crossed to the wrong side of the E4 travelling south. He had been alone in the car. The local radio ran a story that dealt with concern for the future of the Vanger Corporation and the consequences that this death would inevitably have for the company. A hastily composed lunchtime update from the TT wire service had the headline, "A Town in Shock," and it summed up the problems of the Vanger Corporation. It escaped no one's notice that in Hedestad alone more than 3,000 of the town's 21,000 inhabitants were employed by the Vanger Corporation or were otherwise dependent on the prosperity of the company. The firm's CEO was dead, and the former CEO was seriously ill after a heart attack. There was no natural heir. All this at a time considered to be among the most critical in the company's history. Blomqvist had had the option of going to the police in Hedestad and telling them what had happened that night, but Salander had already set a certain process in motion. Since he had not immediately called the police, it became harder to do so with each hour that passed. He spent the morning in gloomy silence, sitting on the kitchen bench, watching the rain outside. Around 10, there was another cloudburst, but by lunchtime the rain had stopped and the wind had died down a bit. He went out and wiped off the garden furniture, and then sat there with a mug of coffee. He was wearing a shirt, with the collar turned up. Martin's death cast a shadow, of course, over the daily life of Hedeby. Cars began parking outside Isabella Vanger's house as the clan gathered to offer condolences. Salander observed the procession without emotion.
"How are you feeling?" she said at last.
"I think I'm still in shock," he said. "I was helpless. For several hours I was convinced that I was going to die. I felt the fear of death, and there wasn't a thing I could do."
He stretched out his hand and placed it on her knee.
"Thank you," he said. "But for you, I would be dead."
Salander smiled her crooked smile.
"All the same, I don't understand how you could be such an idiot as to tackle him on your own. I was chained to the floor down there, praying that you'd see the picture and put two and two together and call the police. If I'd waited for the police, you wouldn't have survived. I wasn't going to let that motherfucker kill you."
"Why don't you want to talk to the police?"
"I never talk to the authorities."
"Why not?"
"That's my business. But in your case, I don't think it would be a terrific career move to be hung out to dry as the journalist who was stripped naked by Martin Vanger, the famous serial killer. If you don't like Calle Blomqvist, you can think up a whole new epithet. Just don't take it out of this chapter of your heroic life."
Blomqvist gave her a searching look and dropped the subject.
"We do still have a problem," she said.
Blomqvist nodded.
"What happened to Harriet?"
"Yes."
Salander laid the two Polaroid pictures on the table in front of him. She explained where she'd found them. Mikael studied the pictures intently for a while before he looked up.
"It might be her," he said at last.
"I wouldn't swear to it, but the shape of her body and the hair remind me of the pictures I've seen."
They sat in the garden for an hour, piecing together the details. They discovered that each of them, independently and from different directions, had identified Martin Wanger as the missing link. Salander never did find the photograph that Blomqvist had left on the kitchen table. She had come to the conclusion that Blomqvist had done something stupid after studying the pictures from the surveillance cameras. She had gone over to Martin Wanger's house by way of the shore and looked in all the windows and seen no one. She had tried all the doors and windows on the ground floor. Finally, she had climbed in through an open balcony door upstairs. It had taken a long time, and she had moved extremely cautiously as she searched the house room by room. Eventually, she found the stairs down to the basement. Martin had been careless. He left the door to his chamber of horrors ajar, and she was able to form a clear impression of the situation. Blomqvist asked her how much she had heard of what Martin said.
"Not much. I got there when he was asking you about what happened to Harriet, just before he hung you up by the noose. I left for a few minutes to go back and find a weapon."
"Martin had no idea what happened to Harriet," Blomqvist said.
"Do you believe that?"
"Yes," Blomqvist said without hesitation. "Martin was dafter than a syphilitic polecat. Where do I get these metaphors from? But he confessed to all the crimes he had committed. I think that he wanted to impress me. But when it came to Harriet, he was as desperate as Henrik Wanger to find out what happened."
"So, where does that take us?"
"We know that Gottfried was responsible for the first series of murders, between 1949 and 1965.
"Okay. And he brought on little Martin."
"Talk about a dysfunctional family," Blomqvist said. "Martin really didn't have a chance." Salander gave him a strange look. "What Martin told me, even though it was rambling, was that his father started his apprenticeship after he reached puberty. He was there at the murder of Leah in Uddevalla in 1962. He was 14, for God's sake. He was there at the murder of Sarah in 1964, and that time he took an active part. He was 16.
"And?"
"He said that he had never touched another man, except his father. That made me think that, well, the only possible conclusion is that his father raped him. Martin called it his duty. The sexual assaults must have gone on for a long time. He was raised by his father, so to speak."
"Bullshit,"
Salander said, her voice as hard as flint. Blomqvist stared at her in astonishment. She had a stubborn look in her eyes. There was not an ounce of sympathy in it.
"Martin had exactly the same opportunity as anyone else to strike back. He killed, and he raped, because he liked doing it."
"I'm not saying otherwise. But Martin was a repressed boy, and under the influence of his father, just as Gottfried was cowed by his father, the Nazi.
So you're assuming that Martin had no will of his own, and that people become whatever they've been brought up to be?"
Blomqvist smiled cautiously. "Is this a sensitive issue?" Salander's eyes blazed with fury. Blomqvist quickly went on. "I'm only saying that I think a person's upbringing does play a role. Gottfried's father beat him mercilessly for years. That leaves its mark."
"Bullshit," Salander said again. "Gottfried isn't the only kid who was ever mistreated. That doesn't give him the right to murder women. He made that choice himself, and the same is true of Martin."
Blomqvist held up his hand. "Can we not argue?"
"I'm not arguing. I just think that it's pathetic that creeps always have to have someone else to blame."
"They have a personal responsibility. We'll work it all out later. What matters is that Martin was 17 when Gottfried died, and he didn't have anyone to guide him. He tried to continue in his father's footsteps, in February 1966, in Uppsala." Blomqvist reached for one of Salander's cigarettes. "I won't speculate about what impulses Gottfried was trying to satisfy, or how he himself interpreted what he was doing. There's some sort of biblical gibberish that a psychiatrist might be able to figure out, something to do with punishment and purification in a figurative sense. It doesn't matter what it was. He was a cut-and-dried serial killer. Gottfried wanted to kill women and clothe his actions in some sort of pseudo-religious claptrap. Martin didn't even pretend to have an excuse. He was organized and did his killing systematically. He also had money to put into his hobby. And he was shrewder than his father. Every time Gottfried left a body behind, it led to a police investigation, and the risk that someone might track him down, or at least link together the various murders."
"Martin Wanger built his house in the 70s, Salander said pensively.
"I think Henrik mentioned it was in 1978.
Presumably he ordered a safe room put in for important files or some such purpose. He got a soundproofed, windowless room with a steel door. He's had that room for 25 years.
They fell silent for a while, as Blomqvist thought about what atrocities must have taken place there for a quarter of a century. Salander did not need to think about the matter. She had seen the videotapes. She noticed that Blomqvist was unconsciously touching his neck.
Gottfried hated women and taught his son to hate women at the same time as he was raping him. But there's also some sort of undertone. I think Gottfried fantasized that his children would share his, to put it mildly, perverted worldview. When I asked about Harriet, his own sister, Martin said, we tried to talk to her, but she was just an ordinary cunt. She was planning to tell Henrik.
I heard him. That was about when I got down to the basement, and that means that we know what her aborted conversation with Henrik was to have been about.
Blomqvist frowned. Not really. Think of the chronology. We don't know when Gottfried first raped his son, but he took Martin with him when he murdered Leah Persson in Uddevalla in 1962. He drowned in 1965. Before that, he and Martin tried to talk to Harriet.
Where does that lead us?
Martin wasn't the only one that Gottfried assaulted. He also assaulted Harriet.
Gottfried was the teacher. Martin was the pupil.
Harriet was what? Their plaything?
Gottfried taught Martin to screw his sister,
Salander pointed at the Polaroid prints.
It's hard to determine her attitude from these two pictures because we can't see her face, but she's trying to hide from the camera.
Let's say that it started when she was 14, in 1964. She defended herself. Couldn't accept it, as Martin put it. That was what she was threatening to tell Henrik about. Martin undoubtedly had nothing to say in this connection. He just did what his father told him, but he and Gottfried had formed some sort of pact, and they tried to initiate Harriet into it too.
Salander said, in your notes you wrote that Henrik had let Harriet move into his house in the winter of 1964.
Henrik could see there was something wrong in her family. He thought it was the bickering and friction between Gottfried and Isabella that was the cause, and he took her in so that she could have some peace and quiet and concentrate on her studies.
An unforeseen obstacle for Gottfried and Martin. They couldn't get their hands on her as easily or control her life, but eventually... Where did the assault take place?
It must have been at Gottfried's cabin. I'm almost positive that these pictures were taken there. It should be possible to check. The cabin is in a perfect location, isolated and far from the village. Then Gottfried got drunk one last time, and died in a most banal way.
So Harriet's father had attempted to have sex with her, but my guess is that he didn't initiate her into the killing.
Blomqvist realized that this was a weak point. Harriet had made note of the names of Gottfried's victims, pairing them up with Bible quotes, but her interest in the Bible did not emerge until the last year, and by then Gottfried was already dead. He paused, trying to come up with a logical explanation. Sometime along the way, Harriet discovered that Gottfried had not only committed incest, but he was also a serial sex murderer, he said.
We don't know when she found out about the murders. It could have been right before Gottfried drowned. It might also have been after he drowned, if he had a diary, or had saved press cuttings about them. Something put her on his track.
But that wasn't what she was threatening to tell Henrik, Blomqvist said.
It was Martin, Salander said. Her father was dead, but Martin was going on abusing her.
Exactly.
But it was a year before she took any action.
What would you do if you found out that your father was a murderer who'd been raping your brother?
I'd kill the fucker,
Salander said, in such a sober tone that Blomqvist believed her. He remembered her face as she was attacking Martin Wanger. He smiled joylessly.
Okay, but Harriet wasn't like you.
Gottfried died before she managed to do anything. That also makes sense. When Gottfried died, Isabella sent Martin to Uppsala. He might have come home for Christmas or other holidays, but during that following year he didn't see Harriet very often. She was able to get some distance from him.
And she started studying the Bible.
And in light of what we now know, it didn't have to be for any religious reasons. Maybe she simply wanted to know what her father had been up to. She brooded over it until the Children's Day celebration in 1966. Then suddenly,
She sees her brother on Jernweg's garden and realizes that he's back. We don't know if they talked to each other, or if he said anything, but no matter what happened, Harriet had an urge to go straight home and talk to Henrik. And then she disappeared.
After they had gone over the chain of events, it was not hard to understand what the rest of the puzzle must have looked like. Blomqvist and Salander packed their bags. Before they left, Blomqvist called Froda and told him that he and Salander had to go away for a while, but that he absolutely wanted to see Henrik Wanger before they left. Blomqvist needed to know what Froda had told Henrik. The man sounded so stressed on the telephone that Blomqvist felt concerned for him. Froda said that he had only told him that Martin had died in a car accident. It was thundering again when Blomqvist parked outside Hedrestad Hospital, and the sky was filled once more with heavy rain clouds. He hurried across the car park just as it started to rain. Wanger was wearing a bathrobe, sitting at a table by the window of his room. His illness had left its mark, but Wanger had regained some colour in his face and looked as if he were on the path to recovery. They shook hands. Blomqvist asked the nurse to leave them alone for a few minutes.
"You've been avoiding me," Wanger said.
Mikhail nodded. "On purpose. Your family didn't want me to come at all, but today everyone is over at Isabella's house."
"Poor Martin,"
Wanger said.
"Henrik, you gave me an assignment to dig up the truth about what happened to Harriet. Did you expect the truth to be painless?"
The old man looked at him, then his eyes widened.
"Martin?"
"He's part of the story."
Henrik closed his eyes.
"Now, I've got a question for you," Blomqvist said.
"Tell me."
"Do you still want to know what happened, even if it turns out to be painful, and even if the truth is worse than you imagined?"
Henrik gave Blomqvist a long look. Then he said,
"I want to know. That was the point of your assignment."
"Okay. I think I know what happened to Harriet. But there's one last piece of the puzzle missing before I'm sure."
"Tell me."
"No, not today. What I want you to do right now is to rest. The doctors say that the crisis is over, and that you're getting better."
"Don't you treat me like a child, young man."
"I haven't worked it all out yet. What I have is a theory. I'm going out to find the last piece of the puzzle. The next time you see me, I'll tell you the whole story. It may take a while, but I want you to know that I'm coming back, and that you'll know the truth."
Salander pulled a tarpaulin over her motorcycle and left it on the shady side of the cabin. Then she got into Blomqvist's borrowed car. The thunderstorm had returned with renewed force, and just south of Gävle there was such a fierce downpour that Blomqvist could hardly see the road. Just to be safe, he pulled into a petrol station. They waited for the rain to let up so that he'd not arrive in Stockholm until 7 that evening. Blomqvist gave Salander the security code to his building and dropped her off at the central Tunnelbana. His apartment seemed unfamiliar. He vacuumed and dusted while Salander went to see Plague in Sundbyberg. She arrived at Blomqvist's apartment at around midnight and spent 10 minutes examining every nook and cranny of it. Then she stood at the window for a long time, looking at the view facing the Slussen locks. They got undressed and slept. At noon the next day, they landed at London's Gatwick Airport. They were met with rain. Blomqvist had booked a room at the Hotel James near Hyde Park, an excellent hotel compared to all the one-star places in Bayswater, where he had always ended up on his previous trips to London. At 5 p.m, they were standing at the bar when a youngish man came towards them. He was almost bald, with a blonde beard. He was wearing jeans and a jacket that was too big for him.
"Wasp?"
"Trinity?" she said. They nodded to each other. He did not ask for Blomqvist's name. Trinity's partner was introduced as Bob the Dog. He was in an old VW van around the corner. They climbed in through the sliding doors and sat down on folding chairs fastened to the sides. While Bob navigated through the London traffic, Wasp and Trinity talked.
"Plague said this had to do with some crash-bang job."
"Telephone tapping and checking emails in a computer. It might go fast, or it could take a couple of days, depending on how much pressure he applies."
Lisbeth gestured towards Blomqvist with her thumb.
"Can you do it?"
"Do dogs have fleas?" Trinity said.
Anita Wanger lived in a terrace house in the attractive suburb of St. Albans, about an hour's drive north. From the van they saw her arrive home and unlock the door sometime after 7:30 that evening. They waited until she had settled, had her supper, and was sitting in front of the TV before Blomqvist rang the doorbell. An almost identical copy of Cecilia Wanger opened the door, her expression politely questioning.
"Hi, Anita. My name is Mikael Blomqvist. Henrik Wanger asked me to come and see you. I assume that you've heard the news about Martin?"
Her expression changed from surprise to wariness. She knew exactly who Mikael Blomqvist was. But Henrik's name meant that she was forced to open the door. She showed Blomqvist into her living room. He noticed a signed lithograph by Anders Zorn over the fireplace. It was altogether a charming room.
"Forgive me for bothering you out of the blue, but I happen to be in St. Albans and I try to call you during the day."
"I understand. Please tell me what this is about."
"Are you planning to be at the funeral?"
"No, as a matter of fact, I'm not. Martin and I weren't close, and anyway, I can't get away at the moment."
Anita Wanger had stayed away from Hedderstad for 30 years. After her father moved back to Hedeby Island, she had hardly set foot there.
"I want to know what happened to Harriet Wanger, Anita. It's time for the truth."
"Harriet? I don't know what you mean."
Blomqvist smiled at her feigned surprise.
"You were Harriet's closest friend in the family. You were the one she turned to with her horrible story."
"I can't think what you're talking about," Anita said.
"Anita, you were in Harriet's room that day. I have photographic proof of it, in spite of what you said to Inspector Morell. In a few days I'm going to report to Henrik, and he'll take it from there.
It would be better to tell me what happened." Anita Wanger stood up.
"Get out of my house this minute!"
Blomqvist got up.
"Sooner or later you're going to have to talk to me."
"I have nothing now, nor ever will have anything to say to you."
"Martin is dead," Blomqvist said. "You never liked Martin. I think that you moved to London not only to avoid seeing your father, but also so that you wouldn't have to see Martin. That means that you also knew about Martin, and the only one who could have told you was Harriet. The question is, what did you do with that knowledge?"
Anita Wanger slammed her front door in his face. Salander smiled with satisfaction as she unfastened the microphone from under his shirt.
"She picked up the telephone about 20 seconds after she nearly took the door off its hinges," she said.
"The country code is Australia,"
Trinity said, putting down the earphones on the little desk in the van.
"I need to check the area code."
He switched on his laptop.
"Okay," she called the following number, which is a telephone in a town called Tennant Creek, north of Alice Springs in the Northern Territory. "Do you want to hear the conversation?"
Blomqvist nodded.
"What time is it in Australia right now?"
"About 5 in the morning.
Trinity started the digital player and attached a speaker. Mikhail counted 8 rings before someone picked up the telephone. The conversation took place in English.
"Hi, it's me. I know I'm a morning person, but I thought of calling you yesterday. Martin is dead. He seems to have driven his car into a truck the day before yesterday."
Silence. Then what sounded like someone clearing their throat, but it might have been,
"Good. But we have a problem. A disgusting journalist that Henrik dug up from somewhere has just knocked on my door here in St. Albans. He's asking questions about what happened in 1966. He knows something."
Again, silence. Then a commanding voice.
"Anita, put down the telephone right now. We can't have any contact for a while. But write a letter. Tell me what's going on."
Then the conversation was over. "Sharp chick," Salander said. They returned to their hotel just before 11. The front desk manager helped them to reserve seats on the next available flight to Australia. Soon they had reservations on a plane leaving at 7:05 the following evening. Destination, Melbourne, changing in Singapore. This was Salander's first visit to London. They spent the morning walking from Covent Garden through Soho. They stopped to have a cafe latte on Old Compton Road. Around 3 they were back at the hotel to collect their luggage. While Blomqvist paid the bill, Salander turned on her mobile. She had a text message.
"Armansky says to call at once.
She used a telephone in the lobby. Blomqvist, who was standing a short distance away, noticed Salander turn to him with a frozen expression on her face. He was at her side at once.
What is it?
My mother died. I have to go home.
Salander looked so unhappy that he put his arms around her. She pushed him away. They sat in the hotel bar. When Blomqvist said that he would cancel the reservations to Australia and go back to Stockholm with her, she shook her head.
No, she said. We can't screw up the job now. You'll have to go by yourself.
They parted outside the hotel, each of them making for a different airport. Chapter 26. Tuesday, July 15th to Thursday, July 17th. Blomqvist flew from Melbourne to Alice Springs. After that, he had to choose either to charter a plane or to rent a car for the remaining 250-mile trip north. He chose to go by car. An unknown person, with a biblical signature of Joshua, who is part of Plagues or possibly Trinity's mysterious international network, had left an envelope for him at the Central Information Desk at Melbourne Airport. The number that Anita had called belonged to a place called Cochrane Farm. It was a sheep station. An article pulled off the internet gave a snapshot guide. Australia. Population of 18 million. Sheep farmers, 53,000. Approximately 120 million head of sheep. The export of wool, approximately $3.5 billion annually. Australia exports 700 million tons of mutton and lamb, plus skins for clothing. Combined meat and wool production, one of the country's most important industries. Cochrane Farm, founded 1891 by Jeremy Cochrane, Australia's fifth largest agricultural enterprise. Approximately 60,000 merino sheep, wool considered especially fine. The station also raised cattle, pigs, and chickens. Cochrane Farm had impressive annual exports to the USA, Japan, China, and Europe. The personal biographies were fascinating. In 1972, Cochrane Farm passed down from Raymond Cochrane to Spencer Cochrane, educated Oxford. Spencer died in 1994 and farm run by widow. Blomqvist found her in a blurry, low-resolution photograph downloaded from the Cochrane Farm website. It showed a woman with short, blonde hair, her face partially hidden, shearing a sheep. According to Joshua's note, the couple had married in Italy in 1971. Her name was Anita Cochrane. Blomqvist stopped overnight in a dried-up hole of a town with a hopeful name of Wanadoo. At the local pub he ate roast mutton and downed three pints along with some locals who all called him Mate. Last thing before he went to bed he called Berger in New York.
I'm sorry, Ricky, but I've been so busy that I haven't had time to call.
What the hell is going on? She exploded. Krista called and told me that Martin Wanger had been killed in a car accident.
It's a long story.
And why don't you answer your telephone? I've been calling like crazy for 2 days.
It doesn't work here.
Where is here?
Right now I'm about 125 miles north of Alice Springs. In Australia, that is.
Mikhail had rarely managed to surprise Berger. At this time she was silent for nearly 10 seconds.
And what are you doing in Australia, if I might ask?
I'm finishing up the job. I'll be back in a few days. I just called to tell you that my work for Henrik Wanger is almost done.
He arrived at Cochrane Farm around noon the following day to be told that Anita Cochrane was at a sheep station near a place called Makawaka, 75 miles farther west. It was 4 in the afternoon by the time Mikhail found his way there on dusty back roads. He stopped at a gate where some sheep ranchers were gathered around the hood of a jeep having coffee. Blomqvist got out and explained that he was looking for Anita Cochrane. They all turned towards a muscular young man, clearly the decision-maker of the group. He was bare-chested and very brown, except for the parts normally covered by his T-shirt. He was wearing a wide-brimmed hat.
"The boss is about 18 miles off in that direction," he said, pointing with his thumb.
He cast a sceptical glance at Blomqvist's vehicle and said that it might not be such a good idea to go on in that Japanese toy car. Finally, the tanned athlete said that he was heading that way and would drive Blomqvist in his jeep. Blomqvist thanked him and took along his computer case. The man introduced himself as Jeff and said that he was the Stads manager at the station. Blomqvist asked him to explain what that meant. Jeff gave him a sidelong look and concluded that Blomqvist was not from these parts. He explained that a studs manager was rather the equivalent of a financial manager in a bank, although he administered sheep, and that a station was the Australian word for ranch. They continued to converse as Jeff cheerfully steered the jeep at about 10 kilometres an hour down into a ravine with a 20-degree slope. Blomqvist thanked his lucky stars that he had not attempted the drive in his rental car. He asked what was down in the ravine and was told that it was the pasture land for 700 head of sheep.
"As I understand it, Cochrane Farm is one of the bigger ranches."
"We are one of the largest in all of Australia," Jeff said with a certain pride in his voice. "We run about 9,000 sheep here in the Makawaka district, but we have stations in both New South Wales and Western Australia. We have 60,000 plus head.
They came out from the ravine into a hilly but gentler landscape. Blomqvist suddenly heard shots. He saw sheep cadavers, big bonfires, and a dozen ranch hands. Several men seemed to be carrying rifles. They were, apparently, slaughtering sheep. Involuntarily, he thought of the biblical sacrificial lambs. Then he saw a woman with short blonde hair wearing jeans and a red and white checked shirt. Jeff stopped a few yards away from her.
"Hi, boss. We've got a tourist," he said.
Blomqvist got out of the jeep and looked at her. She looked back with an inquisitive expression.
"Hi, Harriet. It's been a long time," he said in Swedish.
None of the men who worked for Anita Cochrane understood what he said, but they all saw her reaction. She took a step back, looking shocked. The men saw her response, stopped their joking, and straightened up, ready to intervene against this odd stranger. Jeff's friendliness suddenly evaporated, and he advanced toward Blomqvist. Blomqvist was keenly aware how vulnerable he was. A word from Anita Cochrane, and he would be done for. Then the moment passed. Harriet Wanger waved her hand in a peaceful gesture, and the men moved back. She came over to Blomqvist and met his gaze. Her face was sweaty and dirty. Her blonde hair had darker roots. Her face was older and thinner, but she had grown into the beautiful woman that her confirmation portrait had promised.
"Have we met before?" she said.
"Yes, we have. I am Mikael Blomqvist. You were my babysitter one summer when I was 3 years old. You were 12 or 13 at the time."
It took a few seconds for her puzzled expression to clear, and then he saw that she remembered. She looked surprised.
"What do you want?"
"Harriet, I'm not your enemy. I'm not here to make trouble for you. But I need to talk with you."
She turned to Jeff and told him to take over, then signaled to Blomqvist to follow her. They walked a few hundred feet over to a group of white canvas tents in a grove of trees. She motioned him to a camp stool at a rickety table and poured water into a basin. She rinsed her face, dried it, and went inside the tent to change her shirt. She got 2 beers out of a cooler.
"So? Talk."
"Why are you shooting the sheep?"
"We have a contagious epidemic.
Most of these sheep are probably healthy, but we can't risk it spreading. We're going to have to slaughter more than 600 in the coming week, so I'm not in a very good mood."
Blomqvist said, "Your brother crashed his car into a truck a few days ago. He must have died instantaneously."
"I heard that."
"From Anita, who called you."
She scrutinized him for a long moment. Then she nodded. She knew that it was pointless to deny the fact.
"How did you find me?"
"We tapped Anita's telephone."
Blomqvist did not think there was any reason to lie.
"I saw your brother a few minutes before he died."
Harriet Wanger frowned. He met her gaze. Then he took off the ridiculous scarf he was wearing, turned down his collar, and showed her the stripe left from the noose. It was still red and inflamed, and he would probably always have a scar to remind him of Martin Wanger.
"Your brother had hung me from a hook. But by the grace of God, my partner arrived in time to stop him killing me."
Harriet's eyes suddenly burned.
"I think you'd better tell me the story from the beginning."
It took more than an hour. He told her who he was and what he was working on. He described how he came to be given the assignment by Henrik Wanger. He explained how the police's investigation had come to a dead end, and he told her of Henrik's long investigation, and finally he told her how a photograph of her with friends in Jernvegsgarten in Hederstad had led to the uncovering of the sorrows behind the mystery of her disappearance and its appalling sequel, which had ended with Martin Wanger's suicide. As he talked, dusk set in. The men quit work for the day, fires were started and pots began to simmer. Blomqvist noticed that Jeff stayed close to his boss, and kept a watchful eye on him. The cook served them dinner. They each had another beer. When he was finished, Harriet sat for a long time in silence. At length, she said,
"I was so happy that my father was dead, and the violence was over. It never occurred to me that Martin... I'm glad he's dead."
"I can understand that. Your story doesn't explain how you knew that I was alive." "After we realized what had happened, it wasn't so difficult to work out the rest. To disappear, you needed help. Anita was your confidant and the only one you could even consider. You were friends, and she had spent the summer with you. You stayed out at your father's cabin. If there was anyone you had confided in, it had to be her. And also, she had just got her driver's license." Harriet looked at him with an unreadable expression.
"So now that you know I'm alive, what are you going to do?"
"I have to tell Henrik. He deserves to know."
"And then?" "You're a journalist."
"I'm not thinking of exposing you. I've already breached so many rules of professional conduct in this whole dismal mess that the Journalists' Association would undoubtedly expel me if they knew about it."
He was trying to make light of it.
"One more won't make any difference, and I don't want to make my old babysitter angry."
She was not amused.
"How many people know the truth?"
"That you're alive? Right now, you and me, and Anita, and my partner. Henrik's lawyer knows about two-thirds of the story, but he still thinks you died in the 60s.
Harriet Wanger seemed to be thinking something over. She stared out at the dark.
Mikhail once again had an uneasy feeling that he was in a vulnerable situation, and he reminded himself that Harriet Wanger's own rifle was on a camp bed 3 paces away. Then he shook himself and stopped imagining things. He changed the subject.
"But how did you come to be a sheep farmer in Australia? I already know that Anita smuggled you off Hedeby Island, presumably in the boot of her car, when the bridge reopened the day after the accident."
"Actually, I lay on the floor of the back seat with a blanket over me. But no one was looking. I went to Anita when she arrived on the island and told her that I had to escape. You guessed right that I confided in her. She helped me. And she's been a loyal friend all these years."
"Why Australia?"
"I stayed in Anita's room in Stockholm for a few weeks. Anita had her own money, which she generously lent me. She also gave me her passport. We looked almost exactly like each other, and all I had to do was dye my hair blonde. For 4 years I lived in a convent in Italy. I wasn't a nun. There are convents where you can rent a room cheap to have peace and quiet to think. Then I met Spencer Cochrane. He was some years older. He'd just finished his degree in England and was hitchhiking around Europe. I fell in love. He did too. That's all there was to it. Anita Wanger married him in 1971. I've never had any regrets. He was a wonderful man. Very sadly, he died 8 years ago, and I became the owner of the station."
"But your passport? Surely someone should have discovered that there were two Anita Wangers?"
"No, why should they? A Swedish girl named Anita Wanger, who's married to Spencer Cochrane. Whether she lives in London or Australia makes no difference. The one in London has been Spencer Cochrane's estranged wife. The one in Australia was his very much present wife. They don't match up computer files between Canberra and London. Besides, I soon got an Australian passport under my married name. The arrangement functioned perfectly. The only thing that could have upset the story was if Anita herself wanted to get married. My marriage had to be registered in the Swedish National Registration files."
"But she never did."
"She claims that she never found anyone. But I know that she did it for my sake. She's been a true friend."
"What was she doing in your room?"
"I wasn't very rational that day. I was afraid of Martin. but as long as he was in Uppsala, I could push the problem out of my mind. Then there he was in Hedestad, and I realized that I'd never be safe the rest of my life. I went back and forth between wanting to tell Uncle Henrik and wanting to flee. When Henrik didn't have time to talk to me, I just wandered restlessly around the village. Of course, I know that the accident on the bridge overshadowed everything else for everyone, but not for me. I had my own problems, and I was hardly even aware of the accident. Everything seemed unreal. Then I ran into Anita, who was staying in a guest cottage in the compound with Gerda and Alexander. That was when I made up my mind. I stayed with her the whole time and didn't dare go outside. But there was one thing I had to take with me. I had written down everything that happened in a diary, and I needed a few clothes. Anita got them for me.
I suppose she couldn't resist the temptation to look out at the accident scene, Blomqvist thought for a moment.
What I don't understand is why you didn't just go to Henrik, as you had intended.
Why do you think?
I really don't know.
Henrik would certainly have helped you. Martin would have been removed immediately, probably sent to Australia for some sort of therapy or treatment.
You haven't understood what happened.
Up to this point, Blomqvist had only referred to Gottfried's sexual assault on Martin, leaving Harriet's role out of it.
Gottfried molested Martin, he said cautiously. I suspect that he also molested you.
Harriet Wanger did not move a muscle. Then she took a deep breath and buried her face in her hands. It took 5 seconds before Jeff was beside her, asking if everything was all right. Harriet looked at him and gave him a faint smile. Then she astonished Blomqvist by standing up and giving her stud's manager a hug and a kiss on the cheek. She turned to Blomqvist with her arm around Jeff's shoulder.
Jeff, this is Mikael, an old friend from the past. He's brought problems and bad news, but we're not going to shoot the messenger. Mikael, this is Jeff Cochran, my oldest son. I also have another son and a daughter.
Blomqvist stood up to shake hands with Jeff, saying that he was sorry to have brought bad news which had upset his mother. Harriet exchanged a few words with Jeff and then sent him away. She sat down again and seemed to have made a decision.
No more lies. I accept that it's all over. In some sense, I've been waiting for this day since 1966. For years I was terrified that someone might come up to me and say my name. But you know what? All of a sudden I don't care any more. My crime falls outside the statute of limitations, and I don't give a shit what people think about me.
Crime? Said Mikael.
She gave him an urgent look, but he still didn't understand what she was talking about.
I was 16. I was scared. I was ashamed. I was desperate. I was all alone. The only ones who knew the truth were Anita and Martin. I had told Anita about the sexual assaults, but I didn't have the courage to tell her that my father was also an insane killer of women. Anita had never known about that. But I did tell her about the crime that I committed myself. It was so horrible that when it came down to it, I didn't dare tell Henrik. I prayed to God to forgive me, and I hid inside a convent for several years.
Harriet, your father was a rapist and a murderer. It wasn't your fault.
I know that. My father molested me for a year. I did everything to avoid... But he was my father, and I couldn't refuse to have anything to do with him without giving him some explanation. So I lied and played a role, and tried to pretend that everything was okay. And I made sure that someone else was always around when I saw him. My mother knew what he was doing, of course, but she didn't care.
Isabella knew?
Harriet's voice took on a new harshness.
Of course she knew. Nothing ever happened in our family without Isabella knowing. But she ignored everything that was unpleasant or showed her in a bad light. My father could have raped me in the middle of the living room right before her eyes, and she wouldn't have noticed. She was incapable of acknowledging that anything was wrong in her life or mine.
I've met her. She's not my favourite in the family.
She's been like that her whole life. I've often wondered about my parents' relationship. I realized that they rarely, or maybe never, had sex with each other after I was born. My father had women, but for some strange reason he was afraid of Isabella. He stayed away from her, but he couldn't get a divorce.
No one does in the Wanger family.
She laughed for the first time.
No, they don't. But the point is that I couldn't bring myself to say anything. The whole world would have found out. My schoolmates, all my relatives.
Harriet, I'm so sorry.
I was 14 when he raped me the first time, and during the next year he would take me out to his cabin. Many times Martin came along. He forced both me and Martin to do things with him, and he held my arms while Martin had his way with me. When my father died, Martin was ready to take over his role. He expected me to become his lover, and he thought it was perfectly natural for me to submit to him. At that time, I no longer had any choice. I was forced to do what Martin said. I was rid of one tormentor, only to land in the clutches of another, and the only thing I could do was to make sure there was never an occasion when I was alone with him.
Henrik would have...
You still don't understand!
She raised her voice. Blomqvist saw that several of the men at the next tent were looking at him. She lowered her voice again and leaned towards him.
All the cards are on the table. You'll have to work out the rest.
She stood up and got two more beers. When she came back, Mikhail said a single word to her.
Gottfried.
She nodded.
On August 7th, 1965, my father forced me to go out to his cabin. Henrik was away. My father was drinking, and he tried to force himself on me, but he couldn't get it up, and he flew into a drunken rage. He was always rough and violent towards me when we were alone, but this time he crossed the line. He urinated on me. Then he started telling me what he was going to do to me. That night he told me about the women he had killed. He was bragging about it. He quoted from the Bible. This went on for an hour. I didn't understand half of what he was saying, but I realized that he was totally, absolutely sick.
She took a gulp of her beer.
Sometime around midnight he had a fit. He was totally insane. We were up in the sleeping loft. He put a T-shirt around my neck and pulled it as tight as he could. I blacked out. I don't have the slightest doubt that he really was trying to kill me, and for the first time that night he managed to complete the rape.
Harriet looked at Blomqvist. Her eyes entreated him to understand.
But he was so drunk that somehow I managed to get away. I jumped down from the loft and fled. I was naked and I ran without thinking and ended up on the jetty by the water. He came staggering after me.
Blomqvist suddenly wished that she would not tell him anything more.
I was strong enough to shove an old drunk into the water. I used an oar to hold him under until he wasn't struggling any more. It didn't take long.
When she stopped, the silence was deafening.
And when I looked up, there stood Martin. He looked terrified, but at the same time he was grinning. I don't know how long he was outside the cabin, spying on us. From that moment I was at his mercy. He came up to me, grabbed me by the hair and led me back to the cabin, to Gottfried's bed. He tied me up and raped me, while our father was still floating in the water. And I couldn't even offer any resistance.
Blomqvist closed his eyes. He was terribly ashamed and wished that he had left Harriet Wanger in peace. But her voice had taken on a new force.
From that day on, I was in his power. I did what he told me to do. I felt paralyzed, and the only thing that saved my sanity was that Isabella, or maybe it was Uncle Henrik, decided that Martin needed a change of scenery after his father's tragic death, so she sent him to Uppsala. Of course, this was because she knew what he was doing to me, and it was her way of solving the problem. You can bet that Martin was disappointed. During the next year he was home only for the Christmas holiday. I managed to keep away from him. I went with Henrik on a trip to Copenhagen between Christmas and New Year's, and during the summer holiday Anita was there. I confided in her, and she stayed with me the whole time, making sure that he didn't come near me.
Until you saw him on Jernweg's garden.
I was told that he wouldn't be coming to the family gathering, that he was staying in Uppsala. But obviously he changed his mind, and suddenly there he was on the other side of the street, staring at me. He smiled at me. It felt like a hideous dream. I had murdered my father, and I realized that I would never be free of my brother. Up until then, I had thought about killing myself. I chose instead to flee.
She gave Blomqvist what was almost a look of relief.
It feels fantastic to tell the truth. So now you know.
Chapter 27. Saturday, July 26th to Monday, July 28th. Blomqvist picked up Sallander by her front door on Lundegarten at 10 and drove her to the Norra crematorium. He stayed at her side during the ceremony. For a long time they were the only mourners, along with the pastor, but when the funeral began, Armansky slipped in. He nodded curtly to Blomqvist and stood behind Sallander, gently putting a hand on her shoulder. She nodded, without looking at him, as if she knew who was standing there. Then she ignored them both. Sallander had told him nothing about her mother, but the pastor had apparently spoken to someone at the nursing home where she died, and Blomqvist understood that the cause of death was a cerebral hemorrhage. Sallander did not say a word during the ceremony. The pastor lost her train of thought twice when she turned directly to her. Sallander looked her straight in the eye without expression. When it was over, she turned on her heel and left without saying thank you or goodbye. Blomqvist and Armansky took a deep breath and looked at each other.
"She's feeling really bad," Armansky said.
"I know that," Blomqvist said.
"It was good of you to come."
"I'm not so sure about that."
Armansky fixed Blomqvist with his gaze.
"If you two are driving back north, keep an eye on her."
He promised to do that. They said goodbye, and to the pastor at the church door. Sallander was already in the car, waiting. She had to go back with him to Hedestad to get her motorcycle and the equipment she had borrowed from Milton Security. Not until they had passed Uppsala did she break her silence and ask how the trip to Australia had gone. Blomqvist had landed at Arlanda late the night before and had slept only a few hours. During the drive he told her Harriet Wanger's story. Sallander sat in silence for half an hour before she opened her mouth.
"Bitch,"
she said.
"Who?"
"Harriet fucking Wanger. If she'd done something in 1966, Martin Wanger couldn't have kept killing and raping for 37 years.
Harriet knew about her father murdering women, but she had no idea that Martin had anything to do with it. She fled from a brother who raped her, and then threatened to reveal that she had drowned her father if she didn't do what he said.
Bullshit!
After that, they sat in silence all the way to Hedestad. Blomqvist was late for his appointment and dropped her at the turn-off to Hedeby Island. He asked if she would please be there when he came back.
"Are you thinking of staying overnight?"
she said. "I think so."
"Do you want me to be here?"
He climbed out of the car and went around and put his arms around her. She pushed him away almost violently. Blomqvist took a step back.
"Lisbeth, you're my friend."
"Do you want me to stay here so you'll have somebody to fuck tonight?"
Blomqvist gave her a long look. Then he turned and got into the car and started the engine. He wound down the window. Her hostility was palpable.
"I want to be your friend," he said. "If you want otherwise, then you don't need to be here when I get home."
Henrik Wanger was sitting up, dressed, when Dirk Frode let him into the hospital room.
"They're thinking of letting me out for Martin's funeral tomorrow."
"How much has Dirk told you?"
Henrik looked down at the floor.
"He told me about what Martin and Gottfried got up to. This is far, far worse than I could have imagined."
"I know what happened to Harriet."
"Tell me. How did she die?"
"She didn't die. She's still alive. And if you like, she really wants to see you."
Both men stared at him as if their world had just been turned upside down.
It took a while to convince her to come, but she's alive. She's doing fine, and she's here in Hedestad. She arrived this morning and can be here in an hour. If you want to see her, that is.
Blomqvist had to tell the story from beginning to end. A couple of times Henrik interrupted with a question or asked him to repeat something. Frodo said not a word. When the story was done, Henrik sat in silence. Blomqvist had been afraid that it would be too much for the old man, but Henrik showed no sign of emotion except that his voice might have been a bit thicker when he broke his silence.
"Poor, poor Harriet! If only she had come to me!"
Blomqvist glanced at the clock. It was 4:05.
"Do you want to see her? She's still afraid that you won't want to after you found out what she did."
"What about the flowers?"
Henrik said.
"I asked her that on the plane coming home. There was one person in the family, apart from Anita, whom she loved, and that was you. She, of course, was the one who sent the flowers. She said that she hoped you would understand that she was alive, and that she was doing fine without having to make an appearance. But since her only channel of information was Anita, who moved abroad as soon as she finished her studies and never visited Hedestad, Harriet's awareness about what went on here was limited. She never knew how terribly you suffered, or that you thought it was her murderer taunting you."
"I assume it was Anita who posted the flowers."
"She worked for an airline and flew all over the world. She posted them from wherever she happened to be."
"But how did you know Anita was the one who helped her?"
"She was the one in Harriet's window."
"But she could have been mixed up in... She could have been the murderer instead. How did you find out that Harriet was alive?"
Blomqvist gave Henrik a long look. Then he smiled for the first time since he had returned to Hedestad.
"Anita was involved in Harriet's disappearance, but she couldn't have killed her."
"How could you be sure of that?"
"Because this isn't some damned lockroom mystery novel. If Anita had murdered Harriet, you would have found the body years ago. So the only logical thing was that she helped Harriet escape and hide. Do you want to see her?"
"Of course I want to see her."
Blomqvist found Harriet by the lift in the lobby. At first he did not recognize her. Since they had parted at Arlanda Airport the night before, she had dyed her hair brown again. She was dressed in black trousers, a white blouse, and an elegant grey jacket. She looked radiant, and Blomqvist bent down to give her an encouraging hug. Henrik got up from his chair when Mikael opened the door. She took a deep breath.
"Hi, Henrik," she said.
The old man scrutinized her from top to toe. Then Harriet went over and kissed him. Blomqvist nodded to Frodo and closed the door. Salander was not in the cottage when Blomqvist returned to Hedeby Island. The video equipment and her motorcycle were gone, as well as the bag with her extra clothes and her sponge bag. The cottage felt empty. It suddenly seemed alien and unreal. He looked at the stacks of paper in the office, which he would have to pack up in boxes and carry back to Henrik's house. But he could not face starting the process. He drove to Konsum and bought bread, milk, cheese, and something for supper. When he returned, he put on water for coffee, sat in the garden, and read the evening papers without thinking of anything else. At 5:30, a taxi drove across the bridge. After 3 minutes, it went back the way it came. Blomqvist caught a glimpse of Isabella Wanger in the back seat. Around 7, he had dozed off in the garden chair when Frodo woke him up.
"How's it going with Henrik and Harriet?" he said.
"This unhappy cloud has its silver lining," Frodo said with a restrained smile. "Isabella, would you believe, came rushing into Henrik's hospital room. She'd obviously seen that you'd come back and was completely beside herself. She screamed at him that there had to be an end to this outrageous fuss about her Harriet, adding that you were the one who drove her son to his death with your snooping."
"Well, she's right in a way. She commanded Henrik to dismiss you forthwith and run you off the property for good, and would he once and for all stop searching for ghosts?"
"Wow!" "She didn't even glance at the woman sitting beside the bed talking to Henrik. She must have thought it was one of the staff. I will never forget the moment when Harriet stood up and said, Hello, Mama.
What happened?
We had to call a doctor to check Isabella's vital signs. Right now she's refusing to believe that it's Harriet. You are accused of dragging in an impostor.